Well, last time we need a we need Magil Barrett to come in and give us a last time on the big reveal. It's
is that Gene Roddenberry's wife? You fucking nerd.
It is Gene Roddenberry's wife, amongst other things. Daughter of the Fifth House.
Welcome to Tune Change,
a show where two music jerks try to give albums a chance.
Yeah, so we're doing REM's Go or Up or whatever.
Yes.
It's the one after the drummer retired. That's how old REM, that's how long REM had been a band. That he didn't quit. He retired. and it's very rare for you always hear like broke up, left the band, split up, but like he made it clear like, no, I'm not going to a different rock band. I just don't want to be in any rock bands at all anymore. I'm done. This is the REM record after the drummer retired. And I feel like we got to get into what did we know and when did we know it? Because REM is one of those, you know, one of those bands that we have a long history with.
What did the president know? And when did he know it?
REM is like one of the quintessential like 80s underground bands who made it big, and they are like everyone's either like punchline if you were on the very very punk side, or like if you're one of the bands that wound up following the same pathway, they're the band you like looked up to and idolized because they like seem to have remained human through the whole mess that they got themselves into.
They made it through, they made it out, they made it big, and
they kind of got big on accident. Like the one I love was kind of a surprise hit, and the one I love is on Document, and that's my shit.
It's a great record.
Love Document, and I think it's their strongest record, like top to bottom. It's about 4 or 5 records in. It's definitely rockier than this, like a lot more distorted guitars, lot more aggressive. And it's the peak of my favorite REM thing, which is if you give the song a political title, you can sing about whatever you want and people think you're like, people think you're like worldly and deep. Like you can just sing about a bad date you had, but you give the song a title like, you know, Gone to Guatemala, and everybody's like, oh my God, he's like, he's so well read.
Oh, the American Clash.
Yeah, and they were kind of angling for some like, maybe there could be two bands that matter, and one of them could be REM, is kind of what it felt like at times. But so they started out as basically a mumble pop band. And
out of Athens, Georgia, along with the B-52s.
So they are the college rock band. Like, if college rock is a real genre and not just a radio format, which, I mean, spoiler, it's not, and it is. but if it were a genre, they would be the dead center of that
the
curve.
Platonic, yes. Take the steps to dash and roll it high.
And like the Pixies took this and added a lot more like edge and weird to it. And a lot of other bands took it in, like Nirvana, like Kurt Cobain openly said that About a Girl was like an REM song.
And you can hear that.
Yeah. So like this kind of like jangle pop, like they like the Byrds albums that I don't like. They probably also like the Byrds albums that I do like, but they definitely like the ones I don't like. They like it when they're turning, and I'm not a fan. So like 12 string guitars and mandolin, like they like instruments with doubled strings.
Right. If you're doubling them up, Peter Buck is down with it. And at this point in their career, Up or Go or whatever, just to be clear, we're going to keep doing the bit, but the title of the record is Up. from October 26th, 1998. But they had already been a going concern, you know, since the early 80s.
Murmur came out in 83. Neither of us were born, and that was their first record. And that's what that is them at their mumbliest. Like, the record is called Murmur, for Christ's sake. And it really is a, like, Michael Stipe had to be kind of talked into, like, being articulate, because he was, like, not confident in either his voice or his lyrics. Mm-hmm. And he got over that shit, because there's some songs on this record where it's like, shut the fuck up for a second. So they start out very college rocky. They get kind of a following, and they tour, and they tour in kind of, they were the wave just before, like, the Replacements and stuff like that. So they get kind of big on Accident, and they sign to a major label and stay pretty similar for the next record. Green is their first major label record, and it sounds almost exactly like Document. So they have this record that sounds almost exactly like Document, and that's their major label debut. And then Out of Time is a pretty hard turn into, like, jangle pop, like, really clearly produced, like, jangle pop. I think they still kept some, like, rock elements, but this is where they start, like, doing more pianos and more horns, and we're swelling, and
the edges started to be sanded down.
And the instrumentation got, like, dramatically more diverse. That's the other thing. It's like, that's what they used the major label money for, is, like, not just bring us a cellist and, like, a horn section. So that the you would never have described an 80s REM record as lush, but, like, they have some lush 90s records. And I think it's to their credit, they had a little bit of the, like, 90s a little too polished, like, CD sheen, but it could have been way fucking worse. And I think Scott Litt is probably, you know, has deserves some credit for making sure it didn't get, like, so, like, some of those early 90s Bob Mould records, they just set, like, they are so bright, and the snare is so loud, and everything is just so sharp, and it's like, it's just fatiguing. Everything is just maxed. And REM just kind of avoided that, like, way too polished, like, hey, you forgot the low end kind of production.
Out of Time featured probably their biggest song, Losing My Religion. That's surely the prototypical REM song, or at least the one
you're gonna hear,
most people are gonna know
now. I mean, they were very, very prominent for a while, because, like, Everybody Hurts was everywhere. So they had a bunch of them. They had a little peak, like, 4 or 5 years there, where they were every place. So, well, let's talk about what we were expecting and what we got. I had heard, and I had never heard a single second of this record. Nothing. The line on it at the time was, like, the drummer quit, so they got a drum machine, and now they're a band with a drum machine. And I think that did them a significant disservice, because anyone who would really like REM in 1998 would have been like, drum machines? Nah, I don't think so. they got a session drummer way more than they got a drum machine on this record.
Oh, yeah.
Just, like, in parts per million, like, way more session drummer.
Peter Buck played some drums here and there as well, but
they lead with the drum machine. So three of the first four tracks are probably the heaviest drum machine. After that, it's more likely that you're going to get no drums at all than that you're going to hear a drum machine. And they also kind of do the rock and roll coward thing of like they use it for like hi-hats. Like they want to do the beginning of Take Me Home, but not the bombastic part of Take Me Home. And that's fucking lame. Yeah. So they lean into it three of the first four tracks. And I think it was like at the time it was definitely like a record label marketing thing of like they're into the hip new electronica.
It's the new REM, yeah. And coming out in 1998, that was a thing that was happening all over the place. I think Ray of Light was 1998. You know, the legacy artists were pivoting into electronica in various capacities and to various degrees.
Y'all, we liked the Chemical Brothers so much that we let the Crystal Method have a career. That's how much we like the Chemical Brothers. We got them confused, and we let them both have careers. That's what happened.
Though, it's interesting, and especially on the first track, and I got the feeling that Peter Buck had been listening to Kraftwerk.
Oh, and, big time Kraftwerk, like early drum machine, no processing kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's an interesting mix, I think. And
I think the drum machine stuff is mostly successful. I have no real like.
Oh, absolutely.
It doesn't seem super out of place. It's not or really the worst song in the record by a lot is I think the second track, which is the most non-drum machine shit we got. It's the most drums you could ever want. The drum machine stuff is mostly either like pretty good and actually kind of interesting. It's never the weakness of the track.
Oh, most definitely. You mentioned that second track, Lotus. You had never heard any of this. I, for whatever reason, caught live in 1998. They were on, I believe, David Letterman or perhaps Jay Leno, and Michael Stipe came out in like a literal wizard robe. He was looking like Emperor Palpatine, and they played this. It seemed like a weird time for them as guys, and I don't know if you read that. Apparently, in the previous year, all three of them had various medical maladies, and somebody suffered an aneurysm, and
it wasn't in the previous year. It was that all happened on the Monster Tour.
Okay,
which was
recently,
it was the album before this one. The touring cycle for that. It doesn't surprise me that they would play Lotus, and I would also, Michael Stipe has looked like Emperor Palpatine for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's seemed like he was kind of leaning into it. I agree. I thought it was weak at the time as a 13-year-old, and I think it's, like there is a chorus which some of these songs have, but I like more of the kind of drony or at least kind of more experimental things that are happening on this record. I made note of the fact that there was a chorus, but I think it's lesser in comparison to some of the other stuff here.
This kind of had I was thinking this had a little bit of a Two Against Nature kind of feel to it.
Oh yes, no, that
is not complimentary at all. So Lotus, I mean, the thing that I knew before I heard Lotus and didn't have to look up is that this is a reference to eating the lotus, like in the Odyssey, and it causes you to lose yourself and forget your life and your responsibilities. That's what that phrase means. I knew that before I had heard this song, and then I heard this song. Didn't like it very much, it's the weakest part of the record, I think, by a lot. I think everything else, maybe with the exception of Hope, the song pretty close after this.
Yeah.
Let's just get the like grievances out of the way, I guess. Michael Stipe just can sometimes writes too many doggone lyrics. He gets Thursday mouth and he just like fills all the spaces in the song.
Oh, yes.
And it outstrips like what he had to say, and it stops really having anything to do with the music. And you get the impression that if the band stopped, he would keep going. and it doesn't happen often. But Hope on this record is for sure one of the examples, and he kind of spoils it. Like it's the worst part of the song, and it would have been great otherwise.
Right. No, I enjoyed the music to Hope quite a bit, and
yeah, me too.
I didn't. You know, there weren't a lot of lyrics that I kind of locked onto, apart from Day Sleeper, which we'll probably get to. But you know, I was really taken by, you know, some of the things they were doing sonically after they got the singly stuff out of the way. I feel like there was a lot of vocal here. Brief production junction note. I've listened to this several times, and it always came away feeling a little heterogeneous, or like in a room but not kind of glued together well. I feel like everything was a little, you know, kind of individualized and dry, and it's probably because, you know, edges of that 90s CD sheen that are sneaking in.
I can hear that now that you mention it.
And I think the hot vocals are most prevalent there. I did see that this was the first record to have them in which they printed the lyrics in the album art since Murmur. So they must have been feeling pretty good about the lyrics.
It's not that any of the lyrics are really ever particularly bad. It's just that they're sometimes mediocre and ever present, and it's just the overwhelm, just the like, dude, shut up, like let
the
song...
relentlessness of it, yeah, the relentlessness of the delivery. You know, you can't take the problem that I had kind of getting locked into the lyrics anywhere was that they were always coming at me, and there wasn't ever any time to kind of absorb and reflect and let them live in the space of the song.
First try was a failure, and the intern was a mess, and they did the same to Matthew, and he bled till Sunday night. They're saying don't be frightened, but
yeah, and like his most famous song is like has so much space in it. You are not me. You like it's all space. This is you and me kind of personal preference as well. Yeah. Just like, I don't know, stuff when you're jibber jabbering and
it's not to say that they don't do that well, because
this is obviously
into the world
band. Yeah, they can do it. Obviously, like, we're, you know, if we had fans, we'd get letters. Yeah, so I think this record is, you said once it gets kind of past the singles, I think this record is strongest when it is kind of soaring orchestral sort of chamber pop.
Yeah.
Like them in REM in night swimming mode is not my personal favorite REM, but they can fucking do it. And when they're doing it on this record, that's when it's really like, that's when it's like a B+. Right.
Because
I think realistically it's like this album is like B+, B's and B-, and then Lotus, which is like, I guess you give it a C because it's just like, it's nothing.
Who cast the final stone? Who threw the crushing blow?
You'd brought up the word lush before, and my nitpicking of the mix aside, I like lushness that comes out of, you know, things that aren't just big strings. There's lots of synth on this. There's lots of, I think that it's,
There's a
why not smile that is almost has kind of the shoegazy, you know, lots of reverb, guitar, you know, fuzz guitar, tremolo picking kind of outro that I obviously, you know, am going to gravitate toward.
There's also a lot of slide guitar on this record, yeah. Kind of buried in the mix, but used as a thickener, which is an interesting way to use it. It's also fun to hear a slide guitar that is not just doing the like Merle Haggard thing, like that pedal steel is always used for. That's what I meant, pedal steel. All right, I don't know if I have much more to say about Go or Up or whatever. It's it's a B plus. It's not a departure. It's not any kind of departure from any kind of anything for REM. If they told me the drummer left after this record, I'd been like, okay, it wouldn't have shocked me. This album sounds very much like the REM. This is your mama's REM, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. Certainly, at least since, you know, for the past 10 years, I had heard Lotus, I had heard Day Sleeper before, so, but the thing is that those aren't really representative of what's on this record, and those are kind of the most, what you'd expect from REM. But even the stuff that isn't has that same REM sound and feel. And I think, you know, it's to their credit that it's, you know, that it's executed this well and that they, you know, I agree. And I think we'd mentioned at the top that this is kind of not a lot of peaks, not a lot of valleys, and kind of sanded down and normalized. And I think that's true. This is very much a, you know, veering into adult contemporary and out of indie rock, or just, you know, album rock or college rock or whatever. But I think it's about as good as of an example as you can do that. I forget the gentleman's name, but the person who produced this, who was not Scott Litt, had also produced U2 and Counting Crows. And those are, you know, kind of the same kind of, at least at that point in U2's career, straddling that line between, you know, hey, we're an arena rock band, and hey, this is, you know, this is hair salon music or you know, morning drive time, whatever.
I mean, I wish I could like fight you over the Counting Crows REM connection, but it's tough, but fair. Like that's their post grunge. Like, No REM, no Hootie.
No, you're exactly right.
Southern boys kind of jangling and so
just a state away, Hootie, from South Carolina. Pat McCarthy is the producer of this record.
We weren't gonna get any fucking letters about that. Nobody well, we want to make a lush orchestral pop record. Let's get late 90s Phil Spector. Yeah. Phil Spector. I believe you had some artists who also lost a member and kind of shifted.
I was thinking about bands who have had to make turns like these, and sometimes, you know, to varying degrees of success, and sometimes there are single albums that stick out at you, and then other times there are just kind of career, you know, changes, and there's lots of bands that have had just, you know, revolving doors of members, the Cro-Mags, for example.
Whereas it's like, it's one guy who joined the band when he was 9, and a bunch of people who weren't alive.
But, you know, the one that I immediately thought of when, you know, thinking about albums right after a founding or critical member leaves is, and of course, you know, I've talked about him before. I'm sure I'll mention him again. Wilco, A Ghost Is Born. You know, Jeff Tweedy, famously and on film, you know, kind of chases Jay Bennett out of Wilco. A circle can only have one center, and then they turn around and deliver this really sparse, speaking of craft work, you know, more electronic record that I did not care for at the time. I have gained an appreciation for that through some live versions in which they get more sound back in there. But it was, you know, another turn for a band that lost probably an even more sonically influential member than REM. I mean, you know, I like Bill Berry as much as anybody else, you know, and he's a great drummer, but you know, it's not like if Peter Buck would have left.
Yeah, that to me is, first of all, very much not a good look for Jeff Tweedy to run out the like talented multi-instrumentalist who defined the two best things you'll ever do in your whole life. And yeah, you knew it at the time. Everybody could have fucking told you. You could see it from space. Like, hey, you have peaked already.
Well, and it's funny that you mentioned Flaming Lips, because they had a member leave, and it did, you know, massively change their sound. Mm-hmm. Was Soft Bulletin the one immediately after the other guitarist left?
No,
I'm sorry, Zyrika was
first, and then the Soft Bulletin is the one that you could actually like play that came out after. Like,
it's the one that's meant to be an album, not some kind of. Social, you know, speaking of Andy Kaufman's social experiment.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be an electric Kool-Aid acid test. It's supposed to be like a record album by a band, and you can listen to it with your ears. Zyrika is great, but yeah, it's a big, like, they got Warner Brothers to release their LSD joke because everybody liked the Jelly song. It's great.
And more power to you, fellas.
Oh no, but like, we were talking about Jeff Tweedy. Speaking of crawled up your own ass, Wayne Cone, good gravy.
Yeah.
Anywho,
you know, everybody gets old and gets crazy in their own special way. I think.
Yeah, sometimes, especially the ones who get worshipped like gods, those ones almost always go fucking nuts. All right, you got another one.
I got a couple more here. Sometimes the out of your mind comes a little bit early. I don't know how you feel about Piper at the Gates of Dawn, the debut Pink Floyd featuring frontman Syd Barrett, who was also kind of forced out.
I've heard it before. It's like extremely not my kind of thing. So, good riddance. And they wrote albums about kicking his ass out. Like, so it's like doubly, like, I like the way they sounded better, and it inspired the good material. So this is one of the best additions by subtraction that I've ever fucking seen. It's also a good, ooh, keep this in mind. It'll be one of the rules of our game later, if I remember. There's a can't replace him aspect to it. Like,
okay,
REM, a guy left. I think the noteworthy thing is a guy didn't join. Right, their drummer left, and they're like, "We don't have a drummer now." Where I feel like most bands would be like, "We should get a different drummer." They didn't. They're like,
"Is Matt Cameron available?"
Somehow, always.
He's the hardest working man in show business, and I love him for it. Couple more, kind of infamous. They got a lot better after and are better off for it. Peter Green, founding member of Fleetwood Mac. Don't really care for Peter Green, Fleetwood Mac, but boy, do I love Stevie.
They just added a different group that had good songwriters in it already. Yeah, good move. I found the perfect singer for our band, Paul Simon. Like, it's going to go pretty good. Michael Jackson's going to be our new lead singer.
And then finally, in our, kind of had to pivot hard because we lost a member. Tragically, the Doors released Other Voices in 1971, in the Yikes. Aftermath of the death of Jim Morrison.
I haven't kept up. Did everybody like it? Was it well received?
Well, I am most familiar with it, in just crate digging, 'cause that's the Doors album that you can inevitably find at any flea market booth that has more than 100 records there.
We should have that. If we'd had, we can't do this on the fly. It would be insufferable to listen to, but, this band has a great example of the, like, it's, they have maybe the example of the album that is so easy to find a used CD copy of in Monster.
Ooh,
everywhere. We could have done. Actually, let's put a pin in that for next time. And I mean, by next time, I mean, when I edit this, it'll be like 8 months from now. I'll suddenly remember. And maybe at that point I'll write it down. So I'm not going to write it down right now.
Yeah. Sometimes it works for bands. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the circumstances are retirements. Sometimes the circumstances are, other situations. But it always, is going to be interesting. But I gather that you have a game for us that is going to play around a little bit more about bands and members and who is... Who's critical?
All right, Matt, what does REM stand for?
Rapid Eye Movement.
I think the band's official stance is that it doesn't stand for anything, but right now, REM stands for Remove Essential Members. So we are gonna play not really a game. We're just gonna remember some bands, but I've organized them into. I've found a bunch of bands where I feel like it's pretty hard to pick who you would remove, and at least for this first batch where it's four or more members, you can't replace them. That's the thing to keep in mind. There is no replacement for who you remove from this band. This band just doesn't have that thing anymore.
Okay.
All right. Up first. Led Zeppelin.
I think this one's pretty easy. Robert Plant is
it's
great.
It's Robert Plant by a mile. Mile. I actually don't think he's that great. So I think it's extra easy. Okay, well, let's just go ahead and do the other version of this, which is The Who, because we can talk about him at the same time. It's also Roger Daltrey.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. These like old dinosaur bands, the singer was often, even the ones considered good at the time, are like not my thing for the most part. So I think I would just take an instrumental Led Zeppelin kind of, that's going to be my pick pretty much every time.
There's already instrumental Led Zeppelin and it's great.
That is a good point. That's a really good point, Matt. All right. Up next, Sonic Youth.
This one's tough because I feel like Thurston and Kim, they're kind of the core of the whole operation. I don't know that I have a good enough sense of what Lee Ranaldo was always doing. I know I liked his songs. Is it Scott Schreiner who's the drummer?
Oh, God damn it, Matt. I would have been able to tell you his name 4 seconds ago. Steve Shelley.
Scott Schreiner is the, speaking of replacing members, is the bassist that Weezer got after Matt Sharp left. I feel like...
The hard part is Kim is the best vocalist in the band.
Yes.
Lee is the best songwriter in the band, but the worst vocalist.
And oh yes,
Thurston is like kind of the image of the band. Like
right, yeah,
he's the more effective male singer, and he's always kind of flailing around with his limbs. It's a hard one. I think it's probably Thurston, just musically. Like, the band I would rather listen to with just someone removed is probably without Thurston, but it's a tough one.
I think you're right. I guess in our no replacement rules, you know, if the drummer splits, you know, are they going to then play with a drum machine? But I think you're right. I think the most interesting product after the subtraction would be a Thurston departure.
All right. Up next, this one has a correct answer, I feel like. Wu-Tang Clan.
Well, are we counting U-God and... okay. Because
we are specifically counting U-God, who I feel like is the correct answer to this question of who would you remove from the Wu-Tang Clan. I feel like if Method Man has to take a breath before he says your name in the rap line, you're done. We can't cut out the
Master
RZA.
Killer. That's the other one.
I feel like it's one of them.
Yes. Yeah. Those are the two candidates to be sure.
All right. New Metal Detour. Limp Bizkit. Wait, I just realized you can't pick DJ Lethal. You have to pick one of the other ones.
I don't know. Given that I can't name the bassist or drummer.
Oh, he just died, Matt. I don't know which one of them just died, but one of them just died. Let's agree, whichever one of them didn't just die, he's out.
Yes.
We're kicking him out. All right. The second stop and the last stop on our new metal detour, Slipknot.
I would say the guy who doesn't play the turntables, the guy who plays the sampler, or if we're thinking from a sonic standpoint, Clown.
This band has three auxiliary percussionists. You're going to kick off the guy who wrote the sampler? That's depraved. It's Keg Guy. The answer is Keg Guy. All right. AC/DC.
I know who it's not, and it's Malcolm Young. I think Malcolm Young is
the rhythm guitarist.
Like,
yeah.
Yes. Is the most important member of AC/DC. I also don't think that it's either Bon Scott or Brian Johnson. I feel like in the absence of a clear indicator, I'm gonna go towards the bass player because there's nothing really remarkable there.
I think that's what we're finding. Yeah.
I think Angus Young is fine. I think if I'm picking between Angus Young and whoever the bass player from AC/DC is at whatever point in their career, I think you got to pick the bassist.
All right. Well, let's put that to the test. REM.
Given the results that we've seen here, it seems like Bill Berry is certainly a contender. you know, Mike Mills, all of those high harmonies and, you know, Mills and Buck's kind of dueling and interlocking guitar and bass are so, you know, so critical. Though,
I mean, but know, here, keep in mind, they're like cheating and they have a studio drummer and we're not allowed.
That is true. That's true. We're not allowed. We're not allowed a replacement. I will say that given what I've heard here, I would love to hear a kind of instrumental shoegazy REM without Michael Stipe, you know, whining all over the record.
Yeah.
I think I'm still going to have to say not Mike Mills, Bill Berry, but Michael Stipe makes a case. Or there's a case to be made for Michael Stipe.
Yeah, it'd be weird if he made the case. All right.
I have one for you that I've just thought of back in the hip hop genre, and Bone Thugs and Harmony.
I don't know enough about Bone Thugs and Harmony. I know them essentially to the extent that I know like the Dwarves. I know there's a Busy Bone. Like okay. I know there's a like Sleepy Dwarf.
Well, there is a right answer here because they kind of already did it on their first record. There was a fifth Bone Thug and Harmony member named Flesh and Bone. He's got a verse Love of Money.
The one that has First of the Month?
No. That was just the main four.
Well, then I don't care about him.
Yeah.
All right. Up next, the Mamas and the Papas. This is just to make you not pick John Phillips.
Because
I don't think you can pick John Phillips from a like sonic standpoint.
You got to pick locked the in guy. On that one.
You got to pick the guy with the less complicated Wikipedia page. I don't know his name.
Yeah, I forget. Is he the really tall, dopey guy, or was that John Phillips? They're probably both tall.
John Phillips is the tall, dopey guy. I feel like he was like maybe shorter and kind of doughier. Matt's cat's fucking with everything. All right. The E Street Band.
Okay.
Matt's posture just changed.
I feel like there are two keyboard players, and the one that is not...
That's one too many.
Roy Betaine has to go.
You got two hands, man.
Yeah. Benmont Tench, you know, didn't need any backup. I think whichever of the keyboard players is not Roy Betaine. And that's in the classic, you know, 70s era E Street Band. Cause I feel like E Street Band's kind of one of those bands that just has much like Wilco has collected members. And now there's 20 of them.
We're on to our next segment, which is a power trios, Green Day. Oh, you can replace members here, but you are replacing them with a like guy off the street level competent. You will never notice him for good or ill.
Man, that's tough because every single like,
I knew Green Day would fuck you up.
Well, like, and if we're working on like, what's the baseball stat? Wins above replacement or something? You know,
I'm very
tempted to say that it's Billy Joe Armstrong.
I think that's an insane take.
Well, like Trey Cool is
does he write all the songs?
Drummer. Yeah, I mean, I
so
guess...
you're gonna get a stone average songwriter in your pop punk band, and that's your key to success. Go ask NoFX how that shit works out.
He does have the melodic sense that like makes the whole thing work. I don't know. I guess maybe Mike Dirnt in that case. I can't kick out Trey Cool because he's just that good.
I think that's fair. All right, next Rush.
If we're bringing songwriting in, you know, in as a consideration, I'm tempted to say Alex Lifeson. Because Alex Lifeson's a great guitarrist, you know.
I think it's Alex Lifeson, and it pains me to say it.
There's lots of great guitarists, but, you know, there's only one Geddy Lee, and, you know, there's maybe five Neil Peart's, RIP.
Who are the name them? I'm kidding. You shouldn't try to name them. That's not a word. That's a good use of airtime. Up next, Minutemen. This one's fucking impossible. I can't do this one.
Yeah, boy, that's
because it doesn't work without all three of them being exactly what they are. Like,
right? Yeah, that's a real alchemy kind of thing that is irreplaceable.
All right, up next on the power trios, actually our last power trio, REM without Bill Berry.
Who do we lose? I think it's Michael Stipe.
Yeah, I think that's wild, but this is good Matt Stoking controversy. I think kicking Billy Joe Armstrong out of Green Day is insane, but I understand this one. All right. Next we have a category called "You're Not Allowed to Pick the Drummer." Okay. First up, the Beatles. You can replace. No, you can't replace in this case.
Can't replace him in this drummer. One. He's my boy. I love him. Like, and it's kind of weird because they're at varying points in their career, you know. And of course, a lot of it was just because they wouldn't let him write any songs and put them on the record. But you know, you're tempted to say George because of the weight of the other two personalities. It's certainly not Paul. And
I like to be a contrarian dickhead and say Paul, but I think I should be called on that in the way that you should be called on Billy Joe Armstrong.
I think if it's 1964, it's George. If it's 1969 or 70, it's John.
I was going to say, by 1968, it's Paul for me. I'm like, get your Tin Pan Alley ass out of here.
that's fair with your granny music.
Yeah, it sucks. At least. So, okay. Second and last in our not allowed to pick the drummer, Korn.
Korn has two guitarists, right?
Yeah. And one of them left for like 8 years.
I think that one is.
I'm gonna kick out Monkey because he's had his day. Head is back, and he's got the hair plugs of a new generation. He does too. You should look it up. All right, so that's you aren't allowed to pick the drummer. In our final category.
All right,
I'm just being a dickhead. Daft Punk.
I don't really know enough about them to make an educated recommendation here. So it's kind of, there's two of them, right? It's coin flip.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want the tall one or the shorter one? I'm doing it by aesthetics. I'm kicking the shorter one out. I like a tall DJ.
I will stick to Simon and Garfunkel rules and kick out the tall one.
So that was go or up or something.
Whatever.
Yeah. They revealed and then they did like three more records. I had no idea. I had in my head for a long time that this was their last record, and then I remembered Reveal and I was like, "Oh yeah, I remember that one." And then there's like two more.
Mhm. Mhm. I know that there was I don't know if they were on Fresh Air or something, but maybe it was Michael Stipe on Fresh Air talking about how they, you know,
very on brand.
Right, exactly. Yeah, in the least surprising appearance imaginable. You know how, by this point, and certainly, you know, as they got older, you know, it almost became like a corporation with, you know, dependents and like people's livelihoods and stuff were counting on, you know, not just the band members, but you know, crew and roadies and all this stuff that you know carries forward with its own inertia. For the sake of kind of, you know, keeping people employed, and they were talking about making the decision to kind of actually have to end the band. Last beat on it, Bill Berry, initially said that he didn't want to quit in 1998 if it would have meant the end of REM. It is wild that they, you know, made another 10 or 15 years of music after this. I've not gotten into that, but I'll certainly be returning to this. I liked a couple of these quite a bit, actually. And it's put me in an REM mood. I've heard some of the REM that we've talked about, but, you know, I've not front to backed Out of Time or Green or really even Automatic for the People. So it's a, you know, a totem band to be sure that certainly has received plenty of plaudits, but for good reason.
Yeah, I was always much more into their kind of like jagged rock stuff. I agree that I like some of this stuff. I probably won't go much further, but I think they acquitted themselves pretty well. It was a good deal better than I thought it would be.
Right. Yeah.
In addition to being much less of a departure than I thought it would be.
It grew. It only took about one listen to really grow on me. The first one, I was kind of, you know, I was doing other stuff and listening, and you know, the fact that it was so kind of smooth and uniform, it kind of passed through me. But just on that second listen, I was like, oh, okay, this is actually, you know, really interesting, and worth a listen. Do we want to decide what is worth a listen for next time?
Let's do this Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Okay.
Whatever the main one is.
Yeah, yeah.
I like the idea of picking an artist, but and then letting, like, we'll just search for it, and we'll say what's the main one,
It might be a self-titled, but you'll have to turn in next time to find out. Maybe it has a title. We'll get all into John McLaughlin and his double neck Gibson and fusion and jazz in the 70s and Quaaludes.
There's gonna be robes.
Oh, definitely.
And people are gonna be like, does his shirt have buttons? And at the end of the performance, they're still not going to be sure.
Nehru collars as far as the eye can see. But until then, dear listener, we thank you for joining us for Up or Go or whatever it was that we were doing. Until then, take care of yourselves. Drop us a review if you'd like. We'd love to hear from you. Until then, I am Matt for Brett. Don't forget to listen to music.